From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headlines about eye-popping CEO pay packages just keep coming, even when CEOs don't deliver. $42 million for the ousted Carly Fiorina at Hewlett-Packard, big bucks for the ousted Franklin Raines at Fannie Mae, for the ousted Harry Stonecipher at Boeing. And that's just a taste. The numbers across the board are startling. Since 1993, the average pay for an S&P CEO tripled. Public companies, on average, now give 10% of their profits to their top five executives. And with all the money paid out, real doubts about what it's buying. Tonight on Point, the ongoing uproar over executive pay in America and the scandal of huge and rising pay packages with and without performance. We begin tonight in New York, where the insurance industry's most powerful figure for decades has retired under pressure. Maurice Hank Greenberg said yesterday he is stepping down from insurance giant AIG as non-executive chairman just 2 weeks after his ouster as the company's CEO. Ben White is the Wall Street correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him about the significance of Hank Greenberg's resignation at AIG and the shape of the scandal that sent him packing.
I would say it's quite a significant deal. Hank Greenberg is legendary on Wall Street and has ruled over AIG with an iron fist for decades. So his departure from the firm comes as a great surprise and indicates that the board at AIG takes this inquiry very seriously. Clearly, they have not acknowledged any wrongdoing, but they want to make sure they are doing everything to comply with regulatory inquiries.
These things are pretty subtle, but can you put in a nutshell what's under the microscope here? Where is the scandal rooted?
Right. The scandal is rooted in AIG's accounting for certain reinsurance transactions, the question of whether they engaged in transactions to make their earnings smooth out and improve the quality of their earnings through transactions with offshore reinsurance companies that regulators are probing to see whether they had too close ties to AIG itself, and in essence were transactions with no underlying economic substance.
So reinsurance meaning they back up other insurance companies?
Exactly. Insurance companies, often large insurance companies like AIG, in order to reduce some of their potential liability, will offload it to reinsurance companies through large transactions to take some of the risk off their own books.
And the allegation here that in the process, AIG was manipulating this back and forth to make their bottom line look great for the market.
Exactly. And so their earnings would be consistent and their risk levels would be reduced. And the question is whether these were legitimate transactions with outside entities that were not closely tied to AIG.
And whether they're playing fast and loose with the proper accounting here. Now, Warren Buffett gets tied into this. How? Why?
Indeed. One of the reinsurance companies is General Re, which is a reinsurance company owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's large conglomerate, which owns a number of large businesses, including General Re.
Of course, Warren Buffett, legendary investor, gigantic returns in recent decades, kind of the epitome of the American capitalist today.
And he has always been a man who has prided himself on a reputation beyond reproach, never having been involved in any type of accounting scandals or any type of corporate scandals. And to see his name involved in any way in a inquiry of this magnitude is, I think, shocking to many investors.
His company, Berkshire Hathaway, has put out a statement today saying that he was not aware, had never been briefed on the details of any of this, on the nature or structure of this deal. But the suggestion is that his reinsurance company was playing in this game with AIG, perhaps.
That is what regulators are looking at, and we have learned that they are interested in talking to Mr. Buffett about the General Re transactions with AIG. And as you've mentioned, the statement has come from Mr. Buffett today saying that he was not given detailed briefings on this transaction.
You really can't get much higher up the food chain of American capitalism than Warren Buffett. I mean, it seems in recent weeks, Ben, that the whole sort of top tier of most prominent CEOs in the country is just roiling. Take us across that landscape.
It seems we get new headlines almost every day about a chief executive either ousted from their job over potentially scandalous activity or simply poor performance. You had at Hewlett-Packard several weeks back, Carly Fiorina being ousted after the lackluster merger with Compaq there. You had Harry Stonecipher at Boeing, who was forced out after an affair with a female employee there. Frank Raines at Fannie Mae, pushed out at the end of last year over accounting problems at Fannie Mae. And the list goes on. You have casualties at the top ranks of some of the nation's largest corporations. And I think what you're seeing here is boards of directors taking a much stronger role in moving quickly to remove a CEO who is either ensnared in a scandal or whom shareholders have lost confidence in.
Ben, what's prompting this change in the weather, the way boards are handling these situations?
I think it's a number of factors. Directors feel much more responsible and like they may face personal liability if it's found that they fail to exercise proper oversight over corporate management. They have a fiduciary duty to shareholders to exercise oversight. As we've seen in the WorldCom case and the Enron case, directors have paid personally out of their own pockets settlement money, which is an unprecedented development.
And settlements in the millions in those cases.
In the multi-millions, yes. Mm-hmm. We're talking about real money out of these people's pockets, and they no longer feel that they can stand by and simply rubber stamp management decisions. They need to take an active role.
On the other hand, if we look at compensation, you've written recently that even when performance of some of these executives is poor or tarnished, executives are cashing in quite handsomely. Can you walk us through a bit of that?
Yes, without question, it still pays to be the boss by any measure. Fiorina, for example, at Hewlett-Packard left with an exit package worth about $42 million. Henry Stonecipher at Boeing is entitled to retirement benefits of about $600,000 per year. Franklin Raines at Fannie Mae, the company says he's owed over $100,000 per month in pension benefits.
Per month?
Per month. In other cases, we've looked at a number of large compensation packages this year. For example, at Morgan Stanley, Phil Purcell earned about $22.5 million, even though the company's stock price dropped about 6% in 2004. And there are a number of shareholders there that are unhappy with that. And the list goes on at companies where earnings may have grown substantially, but stock prices may have lagged, are still earning enormous sums of money.
And, of course, how can we forget the case of Richard Grasso, New York Stock Exchange chairman, who left with $140 million retirement and severance package in 2003 after the trouble there. Ben, you describe boards tightening up. Is there evidence that they are tightening up at all on compensation, or is that still kind of an open spigot? What's the dynamic at the cash end of the business?
I would say that that is still an open spigot at this point, and we've seen no evidence of a slowdown in the exponential rise in executive compensation. The nature of compensation is changing to some degree. Stock options are less attractive to companies because they will soon be counted as an expense against earnings, but they're simply being shifted into larger bonuses, larger cash salaries, and restricted shares, which are shares which become available to the executives over a period of time. So the nature of pay is changing, but the total amounts continue to skyrocket.
Ben White, thanks so much for joining us. It's a great overview. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ben White is Wall Street correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us from New York. We're talking tonight about America's giant CEO pay packages, paid with and without performance. You can join the conversation tonight. Is there no limit to the portion of America's wealth that will go to America's corporate executives? As a shareholder, do you still believe big executive compensation is working for your interests? As an employee, is it working for you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Lucian Bebchuk. He's professor of law, economics, and finance at Harvard Law School. He's also director of Harvard Law School's program on corporate governance and is co-author of the book Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Lucian Bebchuk, thanks for being with us tonight.
Great to be here.
And with us from Berkeley, California, co-author of Pay Without Performance, Jesse Fried. He's professor of law at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. Jesse Fried, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you along.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
All right. We've just got a couple of minutes before the break here. Let's jump straight in. Lucian Bebchuk, do we have a systemic problem with executive pay in the United States, or just one-off problems here and there?
Yes, we do, Tom. There is this view that all we have are a few bad apples, but what we show in the book is that the problem is systemic, it's persistent, and it goes down to basic defects in our corporate governance system.
And Jesse Fried, why are you guys say that boards are paying executives these huge multi-million dollar packages even when they're not performing? Why?
Well, it's very simple. Managers have a considerable amount of influence over the board. They're in a cozy relationship. The board has an interest in doing well for the CEO. The people who are not at the table are the shareholders. They're the ones who are being hurt. But their ability to threaten the board with replacement is very limited. And so we have a cozy arrangement between the board members and the CEO.
There's a lot more we want to look at here tonight, but Jack B., it is remarkable that this just goes up and up and up so far, almost regardless of the environment, the climate.
Yes, and Adam Smith, a critic of the joint stock company, saw it coming. I never miss a chance to quote him. He said, the directors of such companies, being the managers, rather, of other people's money than of their own, it cannot well be expected that they should watch over it with the same anxious vigilance with which the partners in a private co-partnery frequently watch over their own. Negligence and profusion, therefore, must always prevail in the management of such companies.
Adam Smith, that invisible hand just never goes away. And we're going to talk about this tying executive pay to performance was supposed to be great exactly for shareholders. I want to come back and look at that. We're talking tonight about the ongoing uproar over executive pay in America, the scandal of huge and still rising pay packages regardless of performance. You can join us tonight. Is there no limit, we ask again, to the portion of America's wealth that will go to the top corporate executives of this country? And how did it come to this? Many millions to CEOs even when they're not performing. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the ongoing uproar over executive pay in America. You can join the conversation tonight. CEOs' bonuses rose 46% last year. Did yours? Average pay for S&P CEOs tripled since 1993. How about your pay? And public companies now give 10% of their profits to their top five executives. Can that possibly be justified? Are corporate boards completely in cahoots here? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Lucian Bebchuk. He's professor of law, economics, and finance at Harvard Law School. He's co-author of Pay Without Performance, Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation, and from Berkeley, California, by Jesse Fried, professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, co-author of Pay Without Performance. Our own Jack Beattie is with us as well. Lucian Bebchuk, let me put it to you. The theory of the case was, as I understood it, link executive pay to performance, and shareholders will prosper like never before. So what if the CEO becomes a gazillionaire? As long as everybody who owns a piece of the company gets rich in the process, what's the problem? This is America. It's capitalism. Everybody should be happy. More productivity, more growth, and profits all around. Did that ever work? Is it working now?
It has not happened, Tom, because this is a slogan that has been useful, has been commonly employed to justify the escalation of pay. But the devil is in the details. And in fact, the way that pay has been designed, pay has not been tightly linked to performance. Bonuses are bonuses in name only. Even equity-based compensation, much of the gains there come from industry-wide or market-wide movements.
In other words, if they've got options that are becoming more valuable, it may not be because they've produced that increased value themselves. They're just riding a wave.
Right. Most of the gains have nothing to do with the manager's own performance, but with those market-wide movements. On top of that, there are the soft landing arrangements when people are pushed out that further decouple pay from performance. And then I hope we'll have a chance to speak more about this. There are the very large, massive retirement benefits that thus far have been largely non-transparent and which turn out to be very little linked with performance.
So when the package, even if it looks reasonable today, what they've been promised for their retirement down the road may be quite eye-popping. Jesse Fried, let me ask you. Americans are famously tolerant of wealthy people in their midst. They dream of becoming wealthy one day themselves. Very often wish these people well, say, good on you. You've succeeded. You've lived the American dream. Is there any reason not to apply that perspective to what's gone on with American executives? Are you saying that something is out of whack here?
Sure. Take athletes. Athletes' pay has skyrocketed over the last 30 years, but you don't see Americans complaining about athletes' pay. Why are they complaining?
Once in a while when their ticket is so high at the ballpark, but not too often. I agree. So what about CEOs?
Well, the athletes that are negotiating these pay arrangements, they're bargaining at arm's length with the clubs that they're going to play for. And everybody understands that it's a market and there's arm's length bargaining between the parties.
And they're bargaining hard.
The problem with CEO compensation is that you don't have this arm's length bargaining. You have a negotiation between the CEO and board members, many of whom he has appointed to the board, most of whom are friendly with him just because of the repeated contact. The directors are granting these large packages not with their own money, but with the shareholders' money. Everybody is interested in being friendly and collegial, and there's mutual back scratching. You know, if the CEO gets more money, maybe the board will get a higher pay. And so we don't have the same type of arm's length bargaining that we have in other areas where people are making large salaries. And that's why I think the public is more upset about the high CEO pay than about the high pay being given to baseball players.
So give us some examples from your research with Lucian Bebchuk of when this is the ratio of performance and pay has just become out of line. Give us some examples that you would cite.
Well, you can look at CEO compensation as a in absolute terms or as a fraction of corporate profits, and it really began to take off in the early 1990s when there was a move to stock option compensation.
Mm-hmm.
As Lucian said before, the devil's in the details. In principle, stock option compensation can be very useful for aligning the CEO's incentives with those of shareholders.
And that's exactly the way it was described all through the 90s. This is a good thing. It puts everybody on the same team.
Well, what's interesting is that managers initially opposed options because they thought that it was going to come as a substitute for their cash compensation.
Mm-hmm.
When it was introduced, however, boards just added it on top of their cash compensation. And when the managers realized that options were sort of a freebie, that more options were not going to lead to reduction in their cash compensation, they took more and more of them. And the market boomed during the 1990s, and shareholders were generally happy because stock prices were going up. There was less attention paid to CEO compensation because everybody was making money, and things just got out of control. We see a renewed focus on CEO pay now that the markets have gone down. Shareholders say, look, I've lost 20% of my stock portfolio. Why is the CEO's pay going up? Why are all these CEOs getting more money?
Seems like a fair question.
Yeah, and it is a fair question.
And the answer? Because of the coziness that just doesn't break, even when performance stinks.
The answer is that pay is not really that coupled to performance. There's no arm's length bargaining between CEOs and boards, And the pay has already achieved some sort of momentum on its own. It's actually continuing to rise, as far as we can tell.
Okay, Lucian Bebchuk, you've done some research that just blew me away. That if I'm reading this right, that when you look across public companies in America, 10% of their profits now go to compensating their top five executives. Have I got that right?
Right. That's correct, Tom. What we did was to look at the aggregate numbers for top five compensation for the period from 1993 to 2003. It's a paper that just came out. And we found first that the aggregate compensation, and listen to that, added up to $300 billion during this period from 1993 to 2003, so
okay, it's a big number, but 10% of their profits is that that's really
right.
What it is,
and that and the percentage. If you look at this aggregate top five compensation as a fraction of aggregate earnings. It went up from 5% in the beginning of this period, in 93 to 95, to 10% during the period 2001 to 2003. So the amount at stake are quite large, and they do matter for investors' bottom line. And if one could cut pay without weakening incentives, which we argue in the book one could do, then the benefits to investors could be very large indeed.
Just to get a perspective on this, Jesse Fried, so now 10% of those earnings going to the top five executives, up from 5%. I mean, I guess hypothetically it could go to 15%, to 50%. Is there a point at which the system begins to break down under the weight of executive compensation, a point at which it becomes absurd?
The system is continuing to chug along. Shareholders are probably suffering, but at some point there'll be enough outrage that boards will be forced to restrain increases in compensation. I should mention that the numbers that Lucian's giving you, they don't include certain forms of compensation that that firms are not required to put dollar values on. So actually, the amounts could be significantly higher.
Higher than 10% of earnings. It's quite incredible. Jack Beatty, step back and take a look at this. You quoted Adam Smith to us, but how do you explain what's going on here?
Well, in some ways, this is rather than an excrescence on the system, it's an expression of it. I mean, we have gone in our time from managerial capitalism to investor capitalism.
But that was celebrated, that transition. Managerial was old and musty. Investor was where the vitality was supposed to lie.
That's true, but it's had some negative effects. I mean, consider that 10% of the equity in the capital markets is held by hedge funds. Their time horizon, about 60 days. 35% more by speculators, about 60 days, and most of the rest of the equity in business, it's held by mutual funds whose average holding is 10 months. The corporation, in other words, is a cash machine for the shareholder. Ownership does not mean responsibility. And the board knows that. And the CEOs know that. They know that this is a cash machine. And because it's there, it's seen that way rather than as an institution evolving over time, the CEO can pig out. He doesn't feel the restraints that, say, an Alfred Sloan felt at General Motors. If Sloan was profuse with himself, that would be known to the workers and it would lower their morale and hurt the company. He identified with the company. But today, that isn't so. And in fact, these stock options have had a perverse effect, precisely in this line, that as we saw in Enron, that the CEO has a motive for making that stock price look as good as it can, even if he has to raid the company to do that. Second, there's another perverse element in here, and that is that these profuse deals often reflect what Peter Drucker has called socially unforgivable crimes, namely when pensions and benefits are linked with eliminating pensions for workers or with firing workers. The Wall Street Journal had a series exposing this. So in other words, every bit of harm the CEO does to the workers, he gets more money for doing. What could be more perverse? At the same time, what could express so clearly the nature of the corporation today?
I want to get another perspective in here. Joining us from Palo Alto, California, Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, author of Life 2.0. Rich Karlgaard, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, Tom. Hey, good to hear your voice, and Jack, too.
It's good to have you with us again, Rich. So you're publisher of the magazine that the founder long called The Capitalist Tool, not shy about celebrating all things capitalist. What do you make of trends in CEO compensation? Is this healthy? Is this somehow off the reservation at this point?
Well, I think Jack made a good point, and so did your previous interviewees, that this is a perversion of capitalism. This is not real capitalism. Capitalism rewards the entrepreneur. You know, we love it when people like Steve Jobs of Apple or Larry Ellison of Oracle or Michael Dell do well because everybody else does well around them. They create something. But when people like Carly Fiorina or Michael Eisner over the last 10 years destroy wealth, we quite rightly get outraged at their big compensation packages.
So what's going on? Why aren't shareholders saying, hey, that's right out of my mouth, never mind the broader society? What about shareholders themselves, Rich?
Well, I think there's a lag effect here. I think we're, 2005 will go down as the year where we all caught on. And capitalism works pretty well over the long term, but in any given cycle, people get away with things. And that's why I would not like to see legislation putting a cap on CEO compensation, but rather let capitalism solve its own problems.
Do you see a serious move afoot
to do so?
Do you see a serious move afoot to cap, actually cap compensation?
Well, you hear these voices, but I would rather, I would rather the system take police itself. That investors throw out people like Michael Eisner and Carly Fiorina and others who are not guilty of crimes, but merely guilty of paying themselves too much and not delivering on performance.
So there's a loss to the bottom line for shareholders if executives are paid too much. What about companies overall, Rich? What's the impact of these giant pay packages on the rest of the company?
Well, I think it ruins morale. The best-selling business book of this decade is Jim Collins' Good to Great, and he points out that there's no correlation and perhaps even a negative correlation between great companies and executive compensation. And I think that's that kind of information may be a little late for some poor investors, but it's getting out into the public sphere right now, and people are recognizing that, that good companies do not operate in this way.
You hang out with the board of directors, Seth. Do you hear directors saying, gosh, we've got to do something about the CEO compensation, but I just don't have the nerve. Larry's my friend. Bob's my friend. I don't want to cut him from $20 million to $5 million.
No, what I'm hearing these days is that nobody wants to be on a board of directors. If they, because of all the work of being on a board today is quadrupled, and I mean that literally, over 5 years ago. So when people agree to join boards, they're actually pretty vigilant. Boards have become markedly more independent over the last couple of years than they were during the bubble. The problem is that it's hard to get people to join boards of directors today.
And may get tougher if the heat comes on. Rich Karlgaard, it's always good to hear from you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, author of Life 2.0. Let's turn to our callers. They've been waiting patiently. Chris is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to change my comment because it sort of dovetails into what was just discussed. One of the problems with voting against CEO compensation for a lot of investors is their institutional investors, their pension funds.
Sure.
They're often the same companies that are being managed by the investment management company are the same. They can't vote against these companies because it's their client, and they do not want to get into a conflict of interest or be seen as doing something negative and then losing the contract to manage their money.
So the institutions are all kind of cross-tied here, you're saying, Chris.
It's a very circular structure, and part of the short-term nature of this problem is that companies' pension funds fall into the quarterly earnings, so it sort of goes around in a circle.
And do you think that it's just gotten out of hand, Chris, or how do you look at executive pay?
It's out of hand because if you take a look at, forget the big well-known companies, just look at many of the S&P 500 companies, you will see people with double their salary for bonuses where the stock is going nowhere
that,
year after year.
Just doesn't seem right. Chris, thanks very much for your call. Lucian Bebchuk, this issue of the kind of overlapping, conflicting, interwoven interests of board members, institutional investors, and management, has it paralyzed boards from doing the right thing?
It's an issue that requires addressing, but it's not the most fundamental issue. What prevents shareholders from intervening is that right now, under the existing rules, their rights are just too weak. Rich talked about investors throwing out management when management is mediocre, but the reality is that right now shareholders are by and large powerless. The legal rules are such that corporate elections are largely a myth rather than a reality. Shareholders cannot put director candidates on the ballots. Mm-hmm. Boards are protected and insulated from shareholders by staggered boards and so forth. So what is necessary to make it possible for investors to throw out poor management, the way that Rich wanted them to be able to do, is to have some changes in the basic rules of the game, and that's what we propose in the book.
We'll come back and look at that, a way in which law, not capping salaries, but making things more transparent just might work. We're talking tonight about the ongoing uproar over executive pay in America. You can join the conversation. Has this all transcended logic? What about simple common sense? And as a shareholder, do you still believe that giant compensation is working for you? As a non-top employee, is it working for you? Does it really take tens of millions of dollars to incent someone to do a job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the ongoing uproar over executive pay in America, the scandal of huge and still rising pay packages, regardless of performance. My guest tonight, Lucian Bebchuk and Jesse Fried, are co-authors of the book Pay Without Performance, the unfulfilled promise of executive compensation. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you have a little sympathy for these CEOs and the volatility of their careers, or are you just steamed? Are we somehow caught in a huge racket here? Can we get out of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Yogesh is calling from Boston. Hi, Yogesh. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a comment.
Yeah.
You brought up the question of volatility and short duration of the careers.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a whole new cadre of these people who, unlike in the past where you started a company, Michael Dell or Ted Wyatt of Gateway, they started a company in their backyard,
right,
and then developed it. But you have nowadays, you have people who want to do an MBA, get into mid-level management, advance in management, and then get a huge compensation for a year or two, regardless of performance, and then get out.
I mean, they're smart people. That's the way the system is set up today. They can do that, so I get the human nature is they will.
Right. But the problem is, individual investor has very little power unless you join together and do something, which is very hard to come about. There will be people who will abuse the system. So I think the only thing I can say is that, you know, it is really up for the federal or the government agencies to impose some regulation where performance is key and is what decides your payment, and such payment should be deferred for a few years.
Yeah, we've got it. Yogesh, thanks very much for your call. It's a great observation. Jesse Fried, this kind of culture that's developed where top executives are simply looking for the big score. They know it's out there. If they get in the right situation, they can get it, and they can be gone.
Well, you do hear people urge that limits be placed on executive pay, or that the government get more involved in pay setting. We're skeptical of those approaches because I don't think the government's going to be able to get it right. Where the government can do something very constructive is in increasing the transparency of executive compensation.
To increase shareholder power, to put the brakes on when it gets out of control.
Well, to provide more information about executive compensation to shareholders and the business press so that we have a better idea of what exactly people are being paid.
Why don't people know now? You see the big reports that come out, the annual reports and the shareholder reports. They're pages and pages thick. It looks like there's a lot of information in there.
Well, that's part of the problem. It's not organized. It's organized in a way that's meant to be very hard to decipher and put together. What happened the last time we had a lot of outrage over executive compensation, which was in the early 1990s, is that the SEC decided to require companies to report certain types of compensation in summary tables, because before that, they had made it even more difficult for people to find out what the CEO was being paid. What's happened since the early 1990s is that compensation consultants and boards and CEOs have figured out ways of delivering all sorts of compensation in ways that does not require it to be put in the summary table. It is reported somewhere in the filings of the company, but there are many filings done during the year, and there's lots of pages, and it's
hard to
put.
You've got to be a kind of research genius to ferret it out.
We've been contacted by newspaper reporters asking us to figure out what various things mean, and we have to spend a lot of time reading them to understand them.
And you're far from the ordinary shareholder. You and Lucian are super well-versed in all this. Lucian Bebchuk, what can be done about it?
Let me put some numbers on the table to concretize what Jesse said and Jack referred earlier to pensions. We just completed a study of the value of executive pensions, which right now do not get reflected in the compensation tables, and therefore they are not included in the standard data sets and the various tables that you see in the media.
So they're kind of invisible in there.
Mm-hmm. They are rather, we call them in the book stealth compensation because they are so...
Stealth.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. We looked at a sample of 30 CEOs who departed in 2003 and 2004. And what we found was that the average value of the pension was $15
million. $15 million. That's the average.
That's the average. Mm-hmm. And that the value of this pension was about one-third of the total compensation that the CEO received during their full service as CEO, and therefore that the numbers that the media and researchers focus on significantly underestimate total compensation.
So we're looking at these numbers of $10 million, $20 million, $100 million, and you're saying on the other side of that, there's another pot of gold that's scarcely even visible, but is waiting at retirement.
Right. And that is not, yes, it does not appear in those tables that all of us are going to read in the executive compensation issues of the various publications like Business Week and others next week. And more importantly, what this leads us is not only to underestimate the total amounts, but also to underappreciate how insensitive pay is to performance, because most of those retirement benefits are decoupled from performance. So when we looked at our sample, we found that once you include pensions in it, the fraction of pay that is salary-like goes up from about 16% to about 40% for all.
So a huge nut that doesn't depend at all on performance. Let's get one more call in here. Patrick's calling from New York City. Hi, Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
So I had a comment, and that was that I sort of came of investing age, you know, in 2001 when a lot of this was just sort of, you know, beginning. And thus, I guess I've decided to vote with my feet or my wallet, and my investments are all in real estate and property and things over which I feel I have, you know, more control.
And not in publicly traded companies, in part because of executive compensation?
Yeah, precisely.
Of course, it's tough to know where to turn, Patrick. You know that old real estate bubble they're talking about out there? I pray for you it isn't so.
Well, I mean, you know, even so, I know that the president of, you know, that my co-op board isn't, you know, making, you know, $200 million a year or something like that.
Right, right. And you've got some control over that. Patrick, voting with his feet, thanks very much for calling in from New York. Jesse Fried, so more transparency, and you think over time that will do it? If we come back to this table in 5 years, in 10 years, are we still going to see this kind of golden aristocracy of golden hellos, golden goodbyes, golden handshakes, golden parachutes? Is it still going to be floating so high above the ordinary American's income?
I don't think we'll ever get to a point where boards are negotiating at arm's length with CEOs over executive compensation. We're always going to have the Adam Smith problem that the directors are minding other people's money and they're not going to have the right incentives. But we can try to reduce the magnitude of the problem in various ways. One is to increase the transparency of compensation so that shareholders have a much better idea of what the CEOs are being paid, which allows them to target those CEOs that are they think are overpaid, mm-hmm. in a way that might be able to get them to restrain their salary. And by targeting, I don't mean throwing them out of office, because as Lucian said before, it's very difficult to do. But having newspaper reporters run stories about them, basically trying to embarrass them and the board to reducing the salary. So that's one approach. Another one is to have institutional investors try to pressure boards, you know, use moral suasion to to make pay more sensitive to performance, to make bonuses more sensitive to performance, make CEOs hold their stock for a considerable period of time. And then there's making it easier for shareholders to replace boards that don't do those things.
So let's link it all up and link it up for real. Jesse Fried and Lucian Bebchuk, co-authors of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Thanks to each of you for being with us tonight. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Jack Beatty, I'm all for big winners in this country, but let's not make some kind of permanent aristocracy, you know, set free from demands of performance. That doesn't sound American.
No, you know, and if the average price for retirement is $15 million, Tom, I'll retire for $1 million. I'll go cheaply.
Yes, so will I, my friend. Thanks for being with us tonight, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, superstar lawyer Johnny Cochran dies today at age 67. This is On Point. Famed attorney Johnny Cochran died of a brain tumor at his Los Angeles home today. He was 67. The charismatic, natty dresser and passionate defense lawyer is best known for representing O.J. Simpson in the former football player's double murder trial. Here, an excerpt from Cochran's closing argument in that case.
O.J. Simpson, in a knit cap from two blocks away, is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Throughout his career, Cochran, the great-grandson of a slave, took on cases with racial themes. He represented former Black Panther Elmer Geronimo Pratt, who spent 27 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. He also represented Reginald Denny, the white trucker who was attacked during the L.A. riots. Joining me now from Los Angeles to talk about Cochran's life is Kermit Maddox, a political consultant and community activist in South Los Angeles. Kermit Maddox, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And also with us is Lori Levinson, a professor of law and former dean at Loyola Law School. During the O.J. Simpson trial, she was the legal analyst for CBS News. Lori Levinson, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So, Kermit Maddox, very mixed views of Johnny Cochran, a guy of tremendous stature, admired in many quarters, and after the O.J. Simpson trial, reviled in others. How do you see the legacy that he leaves?
Well, as an African-American who's very active in the African-American community, I got to tell you, he is universally admired and respected. In fact, he's probably a larger-than-life figure for a variety of reasons. I think principally black people see him as one who is a well-respected attorney who took on cases of police brutality, excessive force, racial discrimination, and most importantly, he took on the criminal justice system and won, which is something that's very rare for African-Americans. So post-O.J. Simpson, he might not be the favorite outside the African-American community, mm-hmm. but certainly in the African-American community, I can't think of anyone who is more universally admired and respected than Johnny Cochran.
And Lori Levinson, you cannot miss that. He just towers in respect in that community. But, of course, you'll recall very well from the O.J. Simpson trial, there was a tremendous polarization in the view of this man after the outcome of that case. Johnny Cochran went to Loyola. Of course, that's where you are. What's your view of his legacy, of the reputation of Johnny Cochran?
I agree. I think Johnny Cochran was a great one, really a one-of-a-kind, a guy who had his own style, his own charm. He understood the criminal justice system. He wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty. He wasn't afraid to play the race card. Now, that was very controversial during the O.J. case, but, you know, sometimes you have to hold it up in front of people so they can see what's happening. And so, yes, it was polarizing. There are many people who always remember him as the guy who got O.J. off, but I think it's better to remember him for all the cases that he did in general, which were civil rights cases, representing defendants who you'd never hear of. And for those of us who just admire great lawyering skills, That's what you saw in Johnny Cochran. He loved to win, and he knew how to win, and he knew how to represent a client. And unfortunately, there are not a lot of lawyers, or there are no lawyers, I could say, who would really take his place.
A long, long history goes going back to the 1960s when he represented the widow of Leonard Detweiler, black motorist killed during a police stop in Los Angeles. He took it to court and then went right on with historic financial settlements, brought lasting changes in police procedure in L.A. Kerman Maddox, you've followed his career for a long time. You're an attorney now yourself. What are your earliest memories now of Johnny Cochran?
Well, actually, I'm not an attorney. I'm a public relations consultant.
Oh, excuse me.
And a college professor. But my earliest memories of Johnny Cochran, Tom, were as a kid watching him on TV defending the Detweiler family against LAPD.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you the impact that had, because when you saw this black man in court taking on the powerful institution of LAPD, which if you were black in L.A., you were always afraid of, and at the end of the day, he won, it motivated many of us to grow up and go to college and be future Johnny Cochrans. And many of my friends, of course, happen to be lawyers, but Johnny was that guy that motivated many of us to just kind of excel in what we did. And I think we often believe that, hey, if this guy can take on that powerful institution called LAPD on a case of racial discrimination and police brutality and win, there's hope for all of us. So he was a tremendous influence on me and many other African Americans at a very, very early age in our stage in our life.
And Lori Levinson, of course, a case before the Supreme Court right now involving Johnny Cochran. I guess he had a disgruntled client who was picketing outside his law office, he sought and got a ruling issuing an injunction against Ulysses Torrey, saying he couldn't walk outside carrying signs that said Johnny Cochran's a bum or whatever it was. A big free speech issue swirling around him, even what turned out to be very late in his life.
Well, that's right, and that case was just argued in front of the Supreme Court, and frankly, it might be the big case in the Supreme Court that Johnny Cochran, even though he isn't here, won't win, because it's very controversial. That judge issued an order sort of barring this plaintiff, defendant from saying anything about Johnny Cochran. And, you know, Johnny Cochran's a public figure, and people will say good things or bad things, but I doubt that the First Amendment allows that type of injunction. You know, I think the last thing on Johnny's mind towards the end of his career was his personal rights. I really do think that at that point he had dedicated himself to helping many others in the community, and people went to him. You know, in fact, many people don't know that Michael Jackson, before he selected a lawyer, went to Johnny Cochran because he was like the godfather. People wanted to know, what would Johnny Cochran do?
Johnny Cochran didn't take his case because he was struggling with health issues?
That's right. He knew for the last many months that he had this terrible brain tumor, but he tried to stay there to help others. And, you know, I had Johnny Cochran come in and speak to students in my class, and the students just loved him because he told it the way it was. And he never gave up. That's the other thing people should remember. Geronimo Pratt case, they initially lost that, and then he fought for many years to get the conviction overturned because it really stuck in his gut that he believed that there had been an injustice.
Mm, a larger-than-life figure. Lori Levinson at Loyola Law School, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Kerman Maddox in Los Angeles, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Johnny Cochran, dead today in Los Angeles at 67. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.